Hello and welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Men with the Golden Tongues. I am your host, Micah, joined by my co-host, Brad.
Meeting you with a view to a kill. I love this fucking song. I love this fucking movie, even though I really, really shouldn't.
Yeah, you shouldn't.
I really, really shouldn't.
You shouldn't, but I'm right there with you. Like, if you want to go, like, in the words of Michael Keaton as Bruce Wayne, if you want to get nuts, Let's get nuts. Why not,
man? Oh, man.
This movie is a gem. It's a movie that Roger Moore has famously said is his least liked Bond film.
Well, no shit. I mean, he was 103 when he made it. So, I mean,
like, he was legitimately 57 years old.
Right. Like, I cannot believe, like, what went through the producer's head when they're like, you know what? Let's bring him back again. Because, like, this is the one where it gets really weird. Like his face in this movie is distractingly weird in this entire film. Because I think he had some work done between this and Octopussy.
I believe so.
And it's very noticeable, and it's very, like you cannot avoid paying attention to it. So he looks weird.
From what I understand, he's wearing a rug also.
Possible. Very possible.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, 57, I'd imagine the hair is starting to thin out a little bit, especially if you see him, like pictures of him 20 years after this and see his hairline then. What else we got? We also have like easily a top three worst Bond girl of all time in this film, Tanya Roberts.
Yeah,
she is not good, but a great Bond villain, someone who is not appreciated as a Bond villain.
Now let me ask you a question regarding Christopher Walken as Max Zorin. I love this villain, I really do, but do you love this villain? Or do you love that?
No, I love Christopher Walken. Yeah, let's not make any bones about that. Yeah, like, it's not like the part. Like if it was played by any other individual, it would not be nearly as good.
I'm so happy that you and I are on the same page with these movies. I can't imagine anybody else doing this.
Well,
if they did, it would be terrible.
Right, because the best parts of his performance in this film are not like anything that's written on the page. It's all of his like little Walkenisms that you know pop up throughout the entire movie. Like that's what makes it for him.
Yeah, man.
And also like Grace Jones, not bad either. And I think her and Christopher Walken had like this unspoken bond to see who could overact whom in this movie. Because this is a scene chewing matchup for the ages, and Roger Moore is just along for the ride.
Yeah, man. And there's one scene in particular where we're gonna get to it, and it's very brief, and it is an exchange between these two, and we're gonna get to it. But yeah, this is a crazy movie. Like I said, Roger Moore didn't like it because, you know, he, in his eyes, this wasn't James Bond.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this wasn't a James Bond movie. Particularly, he didn't like the violence I was reading.
This was a pretty brutal film in terms of violence, especially, like I said, when you get to the end and Walken, we're not even going to call him Zorin. We'll just call him Christopher Walken this film, is a pretty brutal guy at the end, but it's a nice wrinkle to his character that makes him somewhat memorable.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right, let's get into it, right? James Bond is in Siberia.
By the way, if you, I hope you love a lot of close shots of Roger Moore during action sequences, because you're about to get a lot of those in this film.
A lot of close-up shots with really fuzzy backgrounds.
Right, and then a lot of wide-angle shots. Yeah, then a lot of real wide-angle shots from far away. No medium shots in this movie at all. Just close and wide. That's it.
So he's in Siberia, and he finds the dead body of 003. In the snow, and he steals a microchip from him. And all of a sudden, he is ambushed by a bunch of Russians. This scene, when you look at this, you're like, at the beginning, you're like, oh, okay, all right, you know, this is pretty standard fare. And then all of a sudden, it gets really fucking goofy. So the Russians are chasing him. And at one point,
by the way, this is a decent action sequence. I think they had like Willie Bogner on speed dial during all of these films, and they're like, and they just started like shoehorning in skiing sequences just so they could keep hiring this guy for his camera work. Like they just wanted to keep bringing it back over and over again.
Look, it's beautifully shot. Like it's awesome. It's awesome. So at one point, Bond is riding on a snowmobile, and the snowmobile gets destroyed, and it gets blown up, and he gets thrown from it. And all of a sudden, one of the sleds from the snowmobile, the destroyed snowmobile, just falls next to him. So James Bond does his best Xander Cage from XXX impression and takes it and uses it as a snowboard.
Right, which, you know, it's the mid-80s. No one's really heard of snowboarding yet. So this is Bond being ahead of the curve.
Right, and I am all for it, right? I'm now, like, this is really cool.
Now, look, we've talked in this show, especially in the Roger Moore era. So we had the slide whistle from the Man with the Golden Gun during the car stunt. And we call that the worst audio cue of all time. I feel like we might have been hyperbolic a little bit when we said that. We had the Tarzan yell from Octopussy. That was really bad. I don't think it was the worst audio cue of all time in Bond history. This is the worst audio cue in James Bond history right here in this scene.
So he's snowboarding, and all of a sudden, California Girls by the Beach Boys comes on. And he's now let me paint the picture for you, folks. We are in a frozen tundra.
We're in Iceland.
Frozen tundra.
Well, it's supposed to be Siberia. They're actually in Iceland.
Right.
This.
James Bond is wearing a white snowsuit with a white parka, and he's snowboarding on a black, you know, snowboard, right? And he's being chased by a bunch of Soviets on skis. And the Beach Boys comes on. Folks, there are no beaches, there are no boys, this isn't California, and there are no girls to be found.
Well, there is a girl later.
There's a girl later.
When this happens.
Thankfully, the musical cue goes away, but not...
Not until like 30 excruciating seconds passes by.
Yeah.
As he's
like,
going.
There's a couple of verses sung.
Right. That's a chorus. like, this isn't like a two-second thing. Like, it just goes on and on. And apparently, like, this was John Glenn, director John Glenn's idea. Well, I got a message for you, John Glenn. Fuck you. Because this is bullshit. Fucking
this
hate
is
this
bullshit,
shit.
Man. This was so, and this is what I'm talking about with these Roger Moore movies, man. Like, I just don't understand them. And, like, it's like, all right, maybe it was okay in the 70s, you know, it was kind of
weird. But they didn't even get this goofy until these last two. Like Free Your Eyes Only was serious as shit. Moonraker, as ridiculous as Moonraker is as a movie, didn't lend itself into this level of just like fourth wall breaking insanity. And not that anything the actors were doing broke the fourth wall, but just having that cue in there, it's just too cute. It's too fucking cute, and it doesn't belong anywhere in my James Bond film, I'll tell you.
Right. As like you said, as ridiculous as Moonraker was, they at least tried to you know, take it seriously. I can't I can't take this seriously, guys.
It's dumb.
It's dumb.
This isn't a fucking Farrelly Brothers movie, for Christ's sake.
Eventually, the music stops. Bond continues to flee from his pursuers, and he meets up with Agent Kimberly Jones in a submarine fashioned as a little mini iceberg. He hops in. He says, "I got what I needed," and he pulls out what, caviar and vodka, because he's James Bond.
I think he has to have caviar within you know, 500 feet of him at all times.
It's part of getting your license to kill.
Right.
You must have it. And then he beds this woman. This woman who is like a third his age. I mean, come on, man. Like any woman who goes to bed with this dude like has serious daddy issues.
Well, and this is where after he does this film, like, he commented that when the leading ladies that they start casting upon you, you know, aside you, were like your mother's age when you started filming these movies, he's like, that's when it's time to move on.
Yeah, like, it's time to move on. Well, I realized it was time for me to move on when Tanya Roberts' mother was older than her mother. Like, really?
Right.
Now, then you decided, well, maybe it's time.
Well, and that's the thing. He decided to leave. Like, they weren't like, hey, all right, thanks for your service, Raj. Like, we're not going to use you for the next one. He's like, no, I'm going to go now, guys, because it's time for me to hang it up at this point.
Oh man, we'll talk about Roger Moore as a whole later. Now we get the title sequence,
which completely erases the tomfoolery of the previous sequence. By the way,
do you think it was intentional to have that very weird musical cue, then to come, you know, with this song, which is arguably one of the most famous Bond songs?
It's not an arguable fact. Well, no, first of all, it was not intentional to have a, you know, stunning stupid before this, because they didn't know what they had when they first had the song. This is the best Bond song of all time. I'm not going to hear anyone argue to the contrary on this. You can have your Goldfingers, you can have your Live and Let Dies, you can have your Skyfalls. Skyfall is the only one that comes close. Like, that's the only one that can give it a run for its money, I think.
I think you have, like, facts on your side, because
I do. This is the only Bond song to reach number one on the UK Billboard charts of all time.
Yeah. So,
and it was, I mean, and it was recorded by the greatest band of the 1980s.
There you go.
So Duran Duran.
And yeah, man. Like, I can't fault you.
No.
I was singing this in the car on the way home,
because it's fucking awesome. It's a fantastic fucking song. It's perfect. It sounds like a Bond song. It sounds like it does the Duran Duran thing, where it sounds very, very 80s, but still very contemporary.
Yeah,
as well. The title sequence doesn't have a damn thing to do with the fucking movie, but I don't care, because it's perfect. It's so fucking 80s. I can't even get over it. There's neon everywhere in this fucking title sequence. everywhere. And look, this is one time I'm glad that they didn't do fucking title sequences that have anything to do with the film. I don't need a fucking Bond title with, like, horses everywhere and fucking, like, microchips falling from the sky and shit like that.
Hell, they have the title sequence kind of playing to the lyrics of the song. Like, whenever you hear, "But can we dance into the fire," mm-hmm. you see a skier, you know, in flames.
Right.
Dancing.
This was probably Bender's best. This and Spy Who Loved Me, I'd say, are the two best. The two best ones that he did.
I'll give you that. I'll give you that. And this is pretty damn great.
I love this song, and also I think John Barry also. I think the best parts of the score for this film are when he does incorporate the theme from the title into the song, and he does it in an interesting way, because obviously, like, the main riff of the song doesn't really lend itself orchestrally very well, but he manages to make it work through the film. So
yeah, it does work, and you hear it throughout the film, and it just makes you feel good, you know. Just makes you feel good, because especially with all the ridiculous stuff that goes on in this movie, it makes you feel good, and yeah. And it's pretty awesome.
Like, man. I said, you can think that another song is better than A View to a Kill. You would be wrong, but you can think it. I'll allow it, and I'll let you bask in your wrongness. It's fine. And look, and like I said, I have a feeling we're going to do a music episode at some point. So of course we'll really dive deep into it at that.
Yeah.
But yeah, this song, this is it for me. We just passed the best quality part of the movie, though not necessarily the most entertaining part of the movie, because this movie is fucking insane.
That it is. back in England, Q, who for some strange reason is playing with a Star Wars mouse droid.
That is what that is. It's like a bigger version. And by the way, that's all Q fucking does in this film. Like, he's here, and then he's at the end, and both times he's playing with this fucking, like, robot dog thing that he has.
He informs Bond, M, and the Minister of Defense that the retrieved microchip's design is an exact match of an advanced microchip resistant to electromagnetic pulse, and is manufactured by Zorin Industries. And it's thought that Zorin Industries is leaking top secret information to the Soviets.
Mm-hmm.
You know what we forgot to do? We forgot to talk about Moneypenny.
Well, yeah, this is the last go for Lois Maxwell as well, who has been in all 15 Bond movies to this point. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it made sense, because obviously, like, when they recast Bond in the next movie, they're going to be going with a much younger actor, so it would make sense to have a much younger Moneypenny.
Yeah, you're not going to have you're not going to have that weird, you know, sexual innuendo banter with this young guy and his grandma.
This is not like one of her more memorable performances. She's just kind of here, you know, she's doing her flirting thing. But it's worth noting Lois Maxwell, of course, excellent in the role, and the, you know, the only person you really do think of when you think of Moneypenny, even though there's been several since then.
Yeah. I read somewhere that that Lois Maxwell kind of had this idea that Moneypenny would be promoted mm-hmm. to the new M. And they were like, nah, James Bond ain't going to take orders from a woman.
Well, then, you know, fast forward 10 years later.
Right.
And that's exactly what he's doing. I mean, it would make a lot of sense to have, you know, M's secretary then, you know, running
right
the department.
Plus, Lois Maxwell's Moneypenny doesn't seem, you know, like the stern, I'm gonna keep this guy in line, but, you know, oh, I love him anyway. I'm just gonna let him. I'm gonna let him think I'm in charge, but I know he knows best.
I mean, that's kind of what Judi Dench's M ends up doing, though.
Right, right. There, like, so she can play that off, right? Whereas Lois Maxwell is just like, oh, just be back before supper time. Like she's like Aunt May. You know what I mean? So anyway, the MI6 gang, the whole shebang, Bond, M, Q, and Moneypenny go to Pimlico.
Is that the only racetrack you know because you're from Baltimore?
That's it, man. Oh, that's
so,
it.
So actually, they went to Royal Ascot, which is a very famous horse racing facility in England. This is actually I mean, it's famous to people in England, I guess.
Do they have the Kentucky Derby there?
No, they do not have the Kentucky Derby there.
They don't have the Preakness there.
They certainly don't.
And they don't have the Belmont there.
No, they don't have the Belmont Stakes.
Well, that's it. Those are the only three horse races
in the world. this was apparently the first movie that they ever allowed to film at the grounds themselves. They would never allow any other film to actually record there.
Oh wow!
So
that's very cool.
But James Bond gets to go wherever the fuck he wants. He's James
Bond.
That's
right. Even old ass. You know, 57-year-old James Bond. It was senior day at the Ascot. So they go there to observe Zorn Industries owner, a Frenchman named Christopher Walken. A Frenchman with no accent. They made sure to say that he has no accent. Because I'm assuming Christopher Walken cannot do a French accent.
No, he can only do a Christopher Walken accent. It's the only one he knows.
We get a quick backstory on Zorin and his henchwoman / lover, Mayday, played by Grace Jones. And we find out that Zorin's horse miraculously has a come from behind victory in this race. And Sir Godfrey Tibbet, a horse trainer, believes that the horse was doped up.
Doping scandals before, they were ahead of their time before they even realized. Sir Godfrey Tibbet, by the way, played by Patrick McNee, giving Bond yet another Avengers connection. Cause he was, whoever the dude Avenger was on the Avengers TV series.
Oh, that was him?
That was him.
Ray Fiennes, I believe his name was?
In the shitty movie that came out. Yeah, I'm talking about the TV show, the thing that was actually good.
Yeah. So, through Tibbet, Bond meets with Aubergine. And Aubergine is a detective who is investigating the accusations of Zorin's roided-up horse. And during dinner at the Eiffel Tower, I didn't know you could like go in the Eiffel
they
Tower.
I think they do actually have a restaurant in there. I could be wrong about that. You would know better than I do because you've actually been to Paris.
We wanted to go up there, but the line was too long.
Okay.
So we were like, it is a-okay to just take some pictures right out here. People are going to know that we were there. So they're eating dinner in the Eiffel Tower, and Aubergine is killed by Mayday via the classic method of killing someone with a butterfly on a fish hook.
So a couple things. First of all, normally you get a scene in the film that's like an extreme British off with someone who's incredibly British being incredibly British. Well, in this movie, we get to tag in, and instead of a British off, you get a French off with this guy. Because this dude is the most French person that you've ever seen in your entire life. Like, take Gerard Depardieu and turn him up to, like, 15. And that's what this guy is.
Bollinger, 75.
I see you are a connoisseur, Monsieur Bond. Ensuite, Lafitte Rothschild 509, s'il vous plaît.
Another excellent choice.
I'm pleased you approve, since you're paying the bill. Cheers.
Santé, Monsieur Aubergine. You were saying that the Sûreté has no information about Zorin before he came over from East Germany.
Through a personal connection, I saw his dossier myself. But even Sûreté records are sometimes incomplete, eh?
Tell me, why do Zorin's horses beat others with far superior bloodlines?
This is a mystery.
Could he be using drugs?
Nothing showed up with the tests. Later this month, Zorin will hold his annual sales at his stud near Paris. Security is formidable, but the key to this mystery is there. And I, Achille Aubergine, intend to find it.
Qu'est-ce qu'il y a, monsieur?
There's a fly in his suit.
First of all. Second of all, this butterfly fish hook, which I'm assuming was poisoned.
Let's hope so. But you know what? It wasn't established in the movie, so you know what?
We just have to assume that he just got fish hooked and that killed him in the cheek. the worst way to kill someone in the history of murders, possibly.
I gotta agree. But if you are able to do it, it is the most skilled way to kill a man.
And Bond, and by the way, James Bond could not care less that that this dude just bit it in front of him. Like, he does not care. He makes a moment. He takes a moment to make a quip to the waitress about him having a fly in his soup or something along those lines. And he doesn't give a shit. He's got to go chase after the assassin.
The assassin who looks like the referee from Samurai Showdown. Bond learns about Zorin's annual horse sale in a few weeks.
Oh, you missed the did you miss the jump?
No. He gets that information before the guy is fish hooked.
Right. And we put the scene in, by the way, so you can hear the Frenchie be super French. Just in case. Yes, so, he has a horse sale, you're right.
So Bond starts to give chase, and this chase consists of scaling the Eiffel Tower, Bond getting trapped in a fishing line, like the assassin, who is Mayday. Mayday literally casts the rod at James Bond in the middle of the Eiffel Tower, and she lands him.
Right.
It's like a bolo.
And almost dumps him over the edge, by the way.
Right. Like, again, just, he looks like a buffoon.
Either he looks like a buffoon or she missed her calling on, like, the Bass Pro Tour that she should have been. She should have been fucking like a fucking champion bass fisherman.
I'm telling you, man, it takes a lot of skill to kill somebody with a fish.
I guess.
By casting a rod at them.
Eventually she just throws it at him. Like, she just throws the entire rod at him.
Right.
As she's trying to get away.
Like, ah, that didn't work. Fuck it. She's like throwing a gun at Superman. Like, ah, fuck it. This chase also consists of Bond falling in a wedding cake. He gives chase and he falls, he jumps off a bridge onto a boat and into a boat and into a wedding cake.
Well, you're missing a lot here, because there's actually a lot of shit that happens in this. So first of all, Mayday leaps off of the Eiffel Tower.
Oh yeah, that's right.
And then she parachutes onto this boat that's going down whatever river runs through Paris. They actually did the parachute jump for real, which they were kind of worried about doing, because the Eiffel Tower, of course, is narrow at the top, but flares out, you know, it's as you go down. So they had to engineer this jump and be super precise. So they had three guys ready to do it. The first one is this guy BJ Worth, who does most of the aerial stunts for the Bond movies, and you know, so he practices it a bunch of times in different areas, and you know, and so he goes up to the jump, runs off the tower, does the parachute jump, nails it the first time, and they had the backup jumpers that were ready, that were also trained ready to rock and roll, and they were ready to do this and said, hey, you know, we'll do ours too, that way we'll have multiple takes. And Cubby Rocky's like, no. We nailed it the first time. We don't want to take any unnecessary risks, because apparently it was tough for them to get permission in the first place to do the jump off of the Eiffel Tower.
A lot of, like, there were a couple other people who wanted to do it.
Right.
And they couldn't, like, they, it was a, it was, it's a big thing.
Right. It's a big deal. So Kite Rock's like, not like, no, we're not going to worry about it. So these backup guys wanted so badly to do it that the next morning they actually snuck up the tower and each did an unauthorized jump off the tower, which almost got the permission pulled from the city for the production.
That's cool, man.
Because they, like, because they were fucking up. So they got fired, obviously.
Yeah.
As you go. So this jump happens. So after she jumps off the tower, Bond must give chase. So he manages to take an elevator down to the street and then hops into like a Yugo, basically, or like a fucking Geo Spectrum or something in the streets of Paris. And as he's driving, first of all, he's driving like, you know, like a train track protect, you know, crossing thing. He drives through that, tears the roof off the car. Okay, that's fine. So he's driving, you know, without a roof on his car. Then he gets like T-boned in the rear by another car, and literally the back of the car flies off. But Bond is still driving, so he's just driving through the streets of Paris in half of a car, which is ridiculous. But yes,
the visual. The visual of Bond driving this front-wheel drive car, like the top half of it,
right,
is just funny to me.
It's dumb. It's dumb. But then, yeah, like he's, like you said, he gets to the boat. He sees Mayday on the roof of the boat. He leaps off. This is like a tour ship that I guess they're having a wedding on. And like you said, as he lands on the boat, because he does not have the benefit of a soft landing from parachuting onto this thing, he goes right for the roof. And into this newly married couple's wedding cake. quite the gag.
Quite the goofy little chase scene.
Right. And then Mayday gets into a boat that Zorin is piloting alongside the ship, and they drive off. And I love the brief interaction between the two of them, because like they look at each other and Christopher Walken gives like a minor like villain laugh, like ha, 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 ha. And then Mayday just throws her head back and
right, gives just can't. The most they can't even share a scene of like villain laughter, like right. Without trying to one up each other,
without being the most ridiculous thing you've ever seen in your entire life. Oh my lord.
Like I'm watching it now and someone's like, so like, you know, how'd you do? And she gives a head nod.
Like she smiles at him.
Right. But like the head nod is like, it's like her head is made of lead. Like it just goes and then lifts back up. And then he smiles and then she's like, ah, ha, ha. Like, all right. Calm down.
Oh my goodness.
Man.
There's a lot of action in this film. A lot of vehicle action specifically.
Yeah.
Come to think of it, so.
You know how I normally complain about James Bond movies being long?
Mm-hmm.
This is just as long as any other James Bond movie, but I didn't feel it.
Oh, see, that's funny because I'm playing the role of you in this movie. Yeah. They could have easily trimmed a lot of time for this fucking film.
Maybe they could have trimmed like 5-10 minutes off and make it a solid 2 hours, but it's 2 hours, 11 minutes. I was okay with it. I mean, I don't know why.
There is just a lot. I mean, there's a lot of action in this movie, like a lot of action.
Yeah.
So there are a couple scenes with him and Tanya Roberts that really don't need to exist. Honestly.
I like all of them.
Well, yeah.
I mean, if we're being honest, good Lord. So Bond eventually meets with M and Sir Godfrey. And he fills them in on the plot, and Bond and Sir Godfrey travel to Christopher Walken's stud in Chantilly, where Bond poses as St. John Smythe.
James St. John Smythe, which is spelled, yes, St. John Smythe, by the way. I swear to God, they queued up the British name generator for this fucking guy, and it broke. It broke when it came. This is the most British name that you will ever find, ever. Ever.
Do you think that James Bond could, do you think it's like with actors who aren't like good at acting, like first time actors, like they get a role and sometimes their role is their actual, the character's name is the person's first name in real life. Like when John Cena did the Marine, like his character's name was John. And I have to imagine that, for certain actors, they do that so that they know that the director is talking to them. Right, because they're not like they're not paying attention.
So you think James Bond has all of his covers begin like his first name is still James?
Yeah, so that he doesn't forget who he is. Like
he does use another cover that begins with James as well later in the film. Yeah, so. But I mean, if there was someone in the world, and I'd imagine there has to be, whose name was James St. John Smythe, how far up their ass do you think you have to shove the stick in order for a guy to have that name? And to be that British. That's what I want to know.
St. John Smythe.
Right.
So he poses as James St. John Smythe, the horse dealer, and Godfrey plays his manservant, Tibbet.
Which by the way, Bond treats him like absolute shit in this film. Like just to play up the cover. And apparently Roger Moore took some ad lib liberties with the script.
Oh really?
Just to rub it in. Well, because him and Patrick were old friends, so he was enjoying having a laugh at taking the piss on Patrick McNee, as it were, in this film.
You know what? Now that you say that, I totally believe it because they have very good chemistry with one another. It's some of the best acting Roger Moore has done.
And by the way, like you know how you really like Patrick McNee, and you know how his name's not Felix Leiter. Just keep that in mind as you go. So.
They keep the charade going while devising a plan to investigate the now missing horse, Pegasus. Bond gathers intel while at a part, like there's a lot of like ancillary stuff that I'm skipping.
Yeah. And that's fine. Yeah. It's just basically he's doing the spy thing. Apparently, by the way, the story that's told about the Duke that created the actual palace that they went to is the real thing. Like, so there was a Duke, who thought that he was going to be reincarnated as a donkey in the next life. So when he built this like palace, this fucking horse area, the horse stables look fucking like a guy who thinks he's going to be a donkey in the next life would live. Like the horse stables are nicer than the fucking mansion, which is out of control.
They were like, oh, here's the Tibbet was like, oh, those are the stables over there. And there's this big ass building. Right.
Right.
And he's like, oh no, those are the servants' quarters. Here are the stables. And like Brad said, it's just like,
it's like the fucking you know, the ancient Roman Senate, basically.
Right.
Right. It's ridiculous.
Goddamn Palace of Versailles is where he keeps the donkey, the jackasses. Bond and Godfrey go up to the room. They are led up there by Jenny Flex.
By the way, you know who plays Jenny Flex?
Elsa. From the Last Crusade.
Yes, correct. It's Allison Duty is the is the actress. Yeah,
that's
name.
It. I knew she had like a funny name.
Yes,
I couldn't remember her name, but that's Duty.
By the way, I'm still an adult, and I don't think I know what Genuflex is, which is what makes her name funny. By the way,
yeah, Jenny Flex. Like I'm trying to get.
We are going to look it up while we are.
Yeah, you look that up because you might.
So, apparently, genuflex is the act of bending the knees in worship or reverence, or maybe for something else.
Ah, okay.
Possibly.
I gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then that makes sense. Kinda. So they're doing the spy thing. You know, they get a room, they look for bugs and all that, which, you know, it's a little thing, but I still like it in my spy pictures. And he has like a little recorder there to, you know, pantomime them being there while they go out.
So like this, like you said, the recorder that has all this pre-recorded dialogue of basically just St. John Smythe being an asshole to Tibbet. Like, did they have to actually record that dialogue live, or did they only record like 30 minutes and then, you know, throw it on a loop, basically?
Yeah, like,
before they, that's what I want to know. That's what I want to know.
Like, how many shirts do you need pressed, dude? Right. It's very weird. Every 30 minutes, you're wrinkling up shirts. Come on, man. So Bond is at this party, and he is doing some investigating, and he gathers intel at this party on Zorin's various business associates, and he sees what's her name? Taylor's character.
Stacy Sutton.
Stacy Sutton. Well, yeah. I guess it doesn't matter right now.
It doesn't. We'll just call her Tanya Roberts.
Yeah.
So. by the way, Tanya Roberts as a geologist might join Denise Richards, nuclear physicist, as the most unrealistic occupation to actress corollary in this series. I have to imagine.
You are not wrong. You are not wrong at all. Bond is, you know, he does a snooping, and eventually Zorin makes his presence known to Bond. And Bond just, he can't help but be an asshole to the point where he's willing to jeopardize the mission to make a quip about how he knows that, you know, that Mayday is the one that tried to kill him. Right.
Well, and let's be fair as well. They were suspicious of Bond before Zorin even met him. Like Zorin's like number two dude was like this St. John Smythe guy bears looking at. Like is your cover really that bad that like right. immediately like they saw his name, they're like, James St. John Smythe, what the like this has got to be fake.
That this, sounds this can't possibly made be real. Up.
Right.
So, yeah, and then he just can't help himself, right? Like, he's just, he does, I forget what it was, but there was some sort of, like, terrible, terrible fishing pun.
Right, he does the Bond thing. He does the Bond thing where he just, you know, basically says, by the way, I know that you had this French detective killed because I was sitting right next to him. Right. But I'm not that guy.
Right, right. Fucking Mr. I Know Everything. Like, you're an ass. Like, you're an ass.
By the way, his secret, his super gadget for this film is used in this scene, and it is polarized sunglasses that somehow allow him to see that Zorin has a secret lab underneath his mansion. I have polarized sunglasses. I cannot see secret laboratories where I go.
Well, you're not doing it right. You see, you gotta rotate the lenses just right.
Apparently.
And they have to have like Elton John frames. Like they're not, you know, they can't look cool.
Oh, doesn't he also have a sharper image credit card, like universal key as well? Yeah. Is that this one?
I think that was this one.
I think it is.
So Zorin orders his security to watch St. John Smythe even more closely because this asshole just can't help himself. Bond introduces himself to Stacy Sutton with the worst pickup line ever. I believe he says, "Hello, I'm English."
Well, apparently to American rubes, that's all that's necessary to sweep right. them off their feet.
I when I heard that, I was just like, this is James Bond, guys? this is the guy that guys want to be and women want to be with? Like, this is Mr. Cool Guy? Like, hello, I'm English. Could you imagine, like, just going up to somebody and be like, hi, I'm Brad. I have a beard. Like, what? Hi, I'm black. That's how I introduced myself to my wife. Hi, I'm black.
Because she doesn't have eyes, apparently.
Mayday kind of cock blocks St. John Smythe and tells her that tells Stacy that she needs to roll out. Cut to the next scene. Bond and Godfrey locate and break into Zorn's secret lab, where they discover that Zorin is using implanted microchips to release the horse steroids remotely by a switch triggered in his cane. Is this where they have that fight where they put that guy in that
there's like a microchip factory in the back of this horse lab, apparently, because that's where you want your manufacturing, is beneath your fucking horse stables. So Zorn's boxing up like a shit ton of microchips. So they fight this guy, and eventually Bond puts him on the conveyor belt, and you know, they box up, you know, a pallet around him, essentially.
Yeah. It's a scene played for laughs,
right?
You know, it's a little fight scene. James Bond, of course, they each get a guy that they have to fight. You know, the two good guys fight two bad guys. James Bond handily takes care of his guy, and the other guy, his buddy, needs help, so James has to go and save him. His buddy is, what, maybe 5 years younger than him?
Yeah. I would think that if you're a spy and you're trying to be, you know, covert and sneaking around this factory, that you wouldn't kill, or not kill, but incapacitate people in such an obvious way that when someone goes to check on them, they'll know for sure that somebody was down in the basement.
Meanwhile, we get scenes of Mayday and Zorin training together in a very, like, very unsexy, like, very, like, very silly. Like, this is the worst choreography for. I don't even think there was choreography. I think they just said, like, just do your best, and we'll film it.
I like too that when they notify that someone broke, when they notify Zorn that someone broke into the lab, he's, I guess he really didn't have time to change that he's still wearing his gi when he goes down to the laboratory to investigate what's going on.
So our two heroes are trying to flee. James Bond's stunt double jumps across a drawbridge that is opening, because that damn sure wasn't nobody's Roger Moore. And he tries to get back to his room. Zorin and Mayday realizes that she's seen him before at the Eiffel Tower. And she confronts Bond in her room.
Right. He ends up not being able to get to her room because they're basically coming up the opposite steps that would block his path. So he ducks into her room, and then he's basically in Mayday's bed. Like, I was waiting for you, Mayday. Like, were you, Bond? And I love it because Zorin's like, yeah, go fuck him. Go have sex with him. This will be fine.
That's all good.
Right.
It's all good. I'm a psychopath. It's all good. Don't worry. And then, yeah, they do. They get it on. And this has got to be the weirdest pairing of two people having sex ever.
It really is. Because for those of you that don't know who Grace Jones is, and you probably should.
I think you should. She was an icon, especially back in the day. Like, she has a very, very unique look and personality. But yeah, like, Grace Jones is like a 6 foot tall black woman, and in this movie, she has like the funkiest, like, high top fade.
Mm-hmm.
And she is
she basically has the Wesley Snipes hairdo from the first Major League, essentially, just with a higher picture that hairdo with Kid from Kid and Play, and that's kind of what you're rolling with.
It's like a little bit of a pompadour thing going
right.
on. It's very unique, and she has this like accent that you just can't quite place. I think she is like Haitian or something like that.
Jamaican. She's from Jamaica originally.
She's from Jamaica. Okay. Mm-hmm. And yeah, she is something. And then you have Roger Moore, and not just Roger Moore, an aged Roger Moore.
Right. It's that's the weird part. Like, it wouldn't be weird if it was like young strapping Roger Moore. It's just because it's old Roger Moore that it's very odd.
Plus, given the fact that, Roger Moore and Grace Jones did not get along.
No, apparently not.
So this scene in particular, just when you know that, it makes it even that much weirder. Anyway, they get it on. What is this? The second woman that James Bond has sex with in this movie?
So far.
I think he has sex with like four different women in this movie.
Is it four? Yeah, you're right. It is four in this film. Holy shit. Old Roger Moore is fucking a man whore.
Right.
Good Lord.
He's a hoe bag, man. So the next morning after they get it on, Zorn gets Bond into his office, and he very cleverly uses this incredible facial recognition technology to identify the fact that James St. John Smythe is a goddamn secret agent.
Right.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I understand you wish to see me.
You slept well?
A little restless, but I got off eventually.
I have the progeny index on the computer. That's a compilation of thoroughbred bloodlines. Might be helpful to you in selecting your purchase this afternoon. As I see it, you need a stallion for breeding.
A stallion sounds right to me.
I find a computer indispensable. Mm. Mm-hmm. I have a stallion. Descended from that horse there. Misty. According to the computer, we have several horses that might interest you.
Splendid.
Oh. Would you be interested primarily in stamina or speed?
Well, a little of both would be ideal.
I think I have just the horse for you. It's time for my morning ride. Why don't you try him out?
Sounds a very good idea.
I shall get into some riding clothes.
Half an hour, then. Scorpion will collect you.
This is, by the way, this is a very walk-in scene, because as he's talking to St. John Smythe, talking about buying a horse. Like, he actually is getting information about Bond. And so, like, every time the screen pops up with, like, a little bit more info, like, he's doing these, like, it's going. It's very funny. It's very funny.
It is. And again, I can't imagine another actor, like, bringing whatever it is that Christopher Walken has. And you can't like name it, right? Because it's something that is distinctly him.
Yes. It's very Walken-esque. Very Walken-esque. So
it is glorious in this scene, because it's so funny. But yeah, this technology is used to identify the secret agent with his full name and the fact that he has a license to kill. Because that's very, very important. You see, if that license to kill didn't come up, well, then he wouldn't really be a threat. But because he has a license to kill and the machine told him that, now he knows, oh, well, this guy I have to take somewhat seriously now.
But upon learning this information, again, his response is not just to take out a gun and shoot James Bond. It's to take him out for a ride.
For an equestrian death.
On the horse racetrack.
Tibbet goes off to, I forget what James
told him. To go wash the car.
And he's killed by Mayday in a car wash.
Yes. By the way, that was Cubby Rockley's actual Rolls Royce that he's driving in this film.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Very nice. Very nice. Meanwhile, Bond is taken to this, you know, he's taken back to Pimlico, and and he is riding. He's like, I forget what they wager something. They're like, if you could beat me, then, you know, you get something. And if I beat you, then I'm the man or whatever. Right. Right?
Yeah.
And they're, so it's a race. Meanwhile, you know, all of Zorin's goons, who might as well just have goon tattooed on their
really
forehead.
Should. They, I mean, really
Jesus
should.
Jesus Christ. Like, they
these are my friends who are going to be riding with us.
Oh, my God. That's right. He was like, oh, if you win, because he, you know, he's still playing up the whole, you know, horse trainer thing. So he's like, all right, if you win, I'll give you a horse. And, you know, if you win.
Well again, you know, we're remaking Goldfinger.
Yes, thank you.
In this
film.
So this is the golf scene.
This is the golf scene
from Goldfinger, essentially.
And they're doing everything they can to cheat, but Bond's horse miraculously
overcomes all the obstacles. Like he even has like the steeplechase, and he raises the gate higher for Bond's horse, but Bond's horse still leaps in. But of course, his goons get tripped up. like I really need to know what was the end game here, like because the goons are like roughing up Bond as he's riding and shit like that. Were they trying to like make him do like a Christopher Reeve or something? Like what's the deal? Like what are you trying to accomplish by doing this?
That you're willing to sacrifice one of your horses to do it.
Like, I guess. Whatever.
He's a psychopath, though.
He is. No, that he's a psychopath. He plays that up very well. Yes, yes. So.
Yes, he does. He survives the attack, and then he gets put in a car.
So he leaps off the track with the horse, and he's riding through the forest. He sees the Rolls, which he thinks Tibbet is driving. So he jumps from the horse into the car, only to find out that Mayday is actually driving the course. And Tibbet is dead in the back seat, having been killed by Mayday.
Yes.
Yeah.
Then they drive that car into a river.
Right. With Bond in it,
knocked
which again
out.
They do without shooting him first. Like, if you're going to drown him, wouldn't you want him to art? Like, Tibbet was dead. Why wouldn't you want to make sure Bond was dead before you did this?
Right. Like, even if you wanted him, like, to be tortured, like, shoot him in a place where he'll just bleed out and drown. Like, that's what a real psychopath would do.
It's really dumb. It's really dumb. Like, there's absolutely no reason they wouldn't have killed him before pushing the car into the lake, basically. And of course, because Bond isn't dead, he actually comes up with a rather smart plan to basically suck air out of the tire for the car while he waits for Zorn and his goons to leave the lake, because they're waiting with guns in case he surfaces.
Yeah, never mind, like, just shooting him,
right,
and then getting rid of the body.
Exactly. Could have killed him. Could have been done with it, but didn't.
Movie could have been
ahead.
Over 54 minutes in. But anyway, we wouldn't get more of this Christopher Walken goodness. So back at Pimlico, General Gogol.
He's back.
He's back. I really, really miss having like a General Gogol in these movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like, just like a frenemy. You know what I mean?
Well, it's good. I mean, this is, there's no like rival. Like you're not going to have like a Russian guy in this day and age be that guy. You know what I
yeah,
mean?
Yeah, no, not anymore. Well, maybe,
doubtful.
But they wouldn't be able, they wouldn't be like head of the KGB. They would be like a Russian informant.
Right, right.
Fleeing from their president. So, I don't know. Gogol confronts Zorin for killing Bond without permission. And he reveals that Zorin was initially trained and financed by the KGB, but now has gone rogue.
He has. And by the way, who is in this scene for his movie debut?
Who's that?
None other than Dolph Lundgren, my man.
Oh, shit!
Who plays one of the Russian, one of the KGB goons, basically.
Is that him? Is that him, like, right there, right behind him?
Yeah. To the left. Oh, he gets to pull a gun. He was dating Grace Jones at the time, so she was able to get him a very small role in the film.
Oh, snap, son. I will break you. That's cool.
Good morning, Comrade Zordi.
General Gogol, this meeting is ill-advised.
A calculated risk, but necessary since you refuse to answer your control.
Come to the point, General.
You disregard procedure. You did not request approval before eliminating 007. Reprisals might jeopardize ongoing operations.
You jeopardize mine!
Letting the British penetrate the Siberian Research Center.
That was regrettable. Your racing activities attract unnecessary attention, but more disturbing are your unauthorized commercial ventures, and we cannot tolerate that.
The issue is irrelevant. I've made new associations. I no longer consider myself a KGB agent.
We trained you, financed you. What would you be without us? A biological experiment? A physiological freak?
Enough of this! Control yourselves!
You will come back to us, comrade. No one ever leaves the KGB.
And I love how when, like, Zorin's like, oh, maybe I don't need the KGB anymore. And so Mayday comes over to the, and a guy is like, no, you know, does the Russian thing. Like, nobody leaves the KGB. So Mayday comes over and fucking gorilla presses this dude. Yes.
Oh, man. I like Mayday,
it's
man.
It's fantastic.
I love Mayday. I always have, man. Like, not just because it's Grace Jones and she's so, like, interesting to look at. Like, I love the fact that she's just, like, this heavy, but you would not necessarily expect her to be the heavy.
Right. Well, and you know what's funny? Like, the whole KGB subplot, in all honesty, doesn't need to exist. At all.
No.
But I'm glad this scene is in the movie because it's so much fun.
Yeah, it's fun, man. Like, and anything that gives you more walking is a-okay with me.
Right. He's literally laughing about this the entire time, Zorin is. in only the way that Christopher Walken can.
Now we cut to one of the more memorable scenes in the movie, at least for me.
Well, it's because you've seen it before. Like this is ripped from Goldfinger to a T.
Yeah. I mean, that's all this movie is, right? Like, right. Down to the exact same plan, and like it's Goldfinger. Zorin unveils to a group of investors his plan to destroy Silicon Valley, which will give him and his potential investors a monopoly over the gold industry. Zorin. Oh, I mean, the microchip industry. You see, if you destroy all of the microchips in Silicon Valley, if you destroy all the microchips in Fort Knox, my microchips will be worth way more.
Yes.
That's how it works.
Or he'll have a monopoly is actually what he's going after.
Yes. And you'll have to buy my microchips for now until Silicon Valley rebuilds itself in 20 years. In 20 years, the rebuild. I do a terrible Christopher Walken. That's why I don't even attempt it. This scene is great. Down to
the one guy who doesn't want to be a part of the plan.
Right.
Like, hey,
that's okay. Right. You don't want to be a part of my evil scheme? Don't worry about it. You got to step outside, though, because this is proprietary information. Like, it's
because it is literally the exact same scene. Except the way he's killed is a little bit more modern, I guess.
Oh, goodness gracious. That's so funny to me, man. So, yeah, this dude is killed by being thrown out of a blimp. And all right. this scene, this next line is
are you talking about the most ham-fisted way that they've ever gotten the Bond title?
Are you reading my rundown? Because that's exactly the words that I have here. Zorin then delivers the most ham-fisted line in order to mention the title of the film.
Right. It's like there has never been a more ham-fisted delivery of the title in a Bond movie ever.
Oh my God.
Ever. In the entire series.
Oh God. I gotta start talking like that. Like I gotta, whenever we, I think from now on, we're going to have to figure out a way to like very horribly ham fist the title of the movie that we're doing into just normal conversation.
Yeah. That's a good idea. Oh, that's a good idea. And like I said, basically, so we're in San Francisco now and Zorn's in his blimp and they're looking out over the San Francisco Bay at the city. And Zorn says, "What a view." And then Mayday says, "To a kill."
Reverse that. Mayday's like, "Wow, what a view." And he's like, "Yeah, to a kill." I was like, "What the fuck?" Like, I had to rewind it and turn the subtitles on because I know I didn't hear what I just heard. And sure as shit, "Wow, what a view. To a kill." Like, this is these two actors trying to out asshole each other.
Oh my God. It's very kitschy. Oh my God, it's so kitschy.
"Wow. What a view. To a kill."
And again, there have been times in Bond movies where they've definitely towed that line a little bit. Like "For Your Eyes Only" kind of does it at the end when, you know, she's like, "For your eyes only, darling." You know what I mean? Whatever. Right. This is just so. This this is the scene where like Peter Griffin is like, "Ah, see, she right. said it.
They said it. Oh goodness gracious! In San Francisco, Bond learns from CIA agent Chuck Lee that Zorin is a psychopath.
Oh, good. I'm glad we can clear that up.
They say they use the term psychopath like it's like Voldemort. You know right, what I mean? Like right. It's like they're scared to say it.
So by the way, in this scene where Bond arrives in San Francisco and he's at Fisherman's Wharf, apparently Maude Adams is somewhere in the background of scene. Yeah, so she actually makes her third appearance technically in a Bond film. So there That's you fine. Go. Yeah, she was just visiting the set, and they're like, "Yeah, you want to be an extra?" She's like, "Whatever. That's fine." So the reason, by the way, that they went to San Francisco is because Mayor Dianne Feinstein, or now Senator Dianne Feinstein, was really gung-ho about getting more movies to film in San Francisco. So she was like uber cooperative, apparently, and gave them pretty much carte blanche, whatever they wanted to do. For this movie, she would let them do.
Very nice.
Essentially. So, and I know you're happy because, like I said, I know you love San Francisco.
I think that's one of the reasons why I give this movie a pass.
Right.
Is because I absolutely love California, and San Francisco is one of the best cities I've ever been to.
Oh, and by the way, also with Zorin's blimp, if you're wondering why it bears a striking resemblance to the Fujifilm blimp, that unmistakably so, it's because when they were doing all of like the establishing shots of like the Bay Bridge and and this, that, or the other, they couldn't avoid the fucking Fujifilm blimp like in the background. So they so they just made it so that his blimp would look like that, just so that they didn't have to do any like digital editing or anything like that of the pictures.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So yeah, Bond had to be told that Zorin is clinically diagnosed as a psychopath.
Oh, good.
And is the result of a failed steroid experiment by Nazis turned Soviet scientist Carl Mortimer. Bond does some So this scene kind of keeps playing along, and eventually Bond realizes that he has to do some underwater reconnaissance of one of Zorin's oil pumping stations.
Mm-hmm.
Here's your, you know, underwater scene. Bond, while doing these investigations, eventually runs into a Russian spy and former lover, Pola Ivanova.
Yep, that's her name. Now, do you know who they wanted to get for this role?
I do not.
They wanted to get Barbara Bach to play this role.
Oh, that would have been
awesome. To play up on the history between the two.
That would have been cool. That's all right, though. So Ivanova is recording some incriminating evidence on Zorin, and her partner is trying to sabotage the pumping station. Ivanova's partner is caught and killed while trying to place explosives on the rig, but Ivanova and Bond escape.
Mm-hmm.
They go back to her place where...
Was that her place, or is that just like a fucking like Japanese bathhouse?
It's like a bathhouse.
Yeah, I was about to say, I'm pretty sure it's just a bathhouse.
Yeah, I guess that would. I guess that does make sense.
Yeah.
Wow, you got really eclectic sense of style.
Right.
Russian spy. So this is kind of awkward because these two are in this bath, this mm-hmm. steaming hot bath, and this woman who looks. I don't know, maybe 30. And I'm being very generous with that 30. Like she looks like way younger than that, is being seduced by like this old man.
Doesn't he have to try very hard? Because remember, they were former lovers.
Yeah.
This is a scene that if they couldn't get Barbara Bach to do it, they should have just passed.
Yeah, they should have just kind of
on doing it. They should just cut it out, so.
But again, all this doesn't necessarily need to be in here. All this KGB stuff doesn't necessarily need to be in here.
Very, very nice pegging of the age. I believe she was 29 when they filmed this. So, the actress that played her. So,
and again, you know, there's nothing wrong with a 57-year-old man getting it on with a 29-year-old. It just looks weird. Like it looks like something that you would. Like a category that you would find on a porn tube site, you know
right,
what I mean? Like an old young site, you know? I don't know, and I don't believe it. I don't believe it. I'm sorry, I can't. I can't. I don't. I won't. Can't do it.
But like, and the whole point of this scene is because she has a recording of Zorin talking about his plans, basically.
Yes. Yes.
And she's just trying to make sure that she gets that tape out, and Bond's trying to steal it as well. And of course, Bond eventually wins the day with this one. But that's literally the only reason the scene exists. Like, it's not necessary other than that. You could have easily, now I'm doing the Micah thing, you could have easily cut this out and saved like 15 minutes of plot here.
So he gets the tape, he listens to it, and he finds out some more information. So he begins another investigation. He goes to San Francisco City Hall, talks with the head geologist posing as James somebody or other from
Stock. Another ridiculously British name. James Stock of the London Financial Times.
I mean, they're literally running out of names. They just chose a stock name.
Right. Right, for this financial paper.
Eventually he stalks Stacy Sutton to her home. Because that's what's going on. This 57-year-old man is stalking this, you know, 20-something Stacy Sutton to her home, where the two are. So he runs up on her. First of all, breaking and entering, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she grabs a shotgun that's filled with rock salt. First of all, nah, man, like you gotta not be afraid to kill a man that comes into your home. Especially when you got nice stuff, lady. And he makes himself known. She pulls out a shotgun, and
you know, they start talking and they realize there are bad guys out there. So James Bond grabs the shotgun, and he uses it, on some of these goons. And he's like, what the fuck? Why aren't these people dying? Like, I have a license to kill. Why aren't they dying? Just like, well, it's filled with rock salt. And, we get a little action scene where Roger Moore's stunt double does a bunch of barrel rolls and action movie rolls while, you know, with this hunting gun.
I also like he pushes the one henchman like through the railing on the top floor, the cutaway railing that as this perfectly square piece of railing falls out as the guy falls down. Apparently he also hits one of them with an urn, which was proposed to have grandfather's ashes in it, according to Stacey Sutton. But when he hits the guy with the urn, there is no ash. Yeah, it's just an empty fucking urn.
I mean, maybe she's crazy and she thought that was her granddad.
I guess.
So they're ambushed by the goons. They fight. And all of a sudden, the goons just kind of flee in terror as they are outmatched by a 57-year-old man.
With a shotgun filled with rock salt.
With a shotgun full of rock salt and a woman who, for some strange reason, just does not know how to throw a punch.
Which is amazing considering that she used to be on fucking Charlie's Angels.
We find out that Stacy is a state geologist and the heiress to Zorin's competitor in the oil business. So Bond and Stacy meet with the chief geologist that Bond met with before.
Oh, by the way, I just have to mention, as they're talking about this, Bond makes her a quiche. Of course he does. Yo. It is 1985, after all.
And this stupid woman, she's like, what is this? Like, it's a quiche. I'm like, what's that? It's an omelet.
It is. Like, did your parents used to make quiche back in the day?
Yes, and we called it quiche.
My mom did as well. Yeah, mom did as well.
My wife still makes quiche.
Does she really? I have not had quiche in a long. Like that thing was a fucking staple of the 80s.
Yeah,
essentially.
Man.
For those who don't know what the fuck a quiche is. It's first basically all, like an egg pie with fixins.
It's an egg pie, and it looks like it's pronounced quickie, but it's not. It's quiche. If you see a word that looks like quickie, don't call it quickie, because you will be laughed at.
You will.
Quiche is great, though.
Yeah, quiche is pretty good.
Depending on what you put in it. My wife likes to experiment. I'm like,
I like the same shit in a quiche that I would like in an omelet. You know, you put some bacon in there, tomatoes, spinach, cheese. Right. You're good. That's all you need.
That's all you need, man. That's all you need. The two of them. Yeah, you're right. These scenes with those two,
mm-hmm.
like they run a little long.
Very, very, very. Like I said, those two very long. She also like so many weird mannerisms that you just don't expect to get. From a Bond girl, like the phrase "you betcha." I don't know why. That's just really unsettling to me.
Why did she change her clothes? Like
I don't know
when she drops her granddad on that goon, and then they flee in terror because, like, holy shit, this woman thinks she just killed her grandfather over my head. Let's get out of here. She's wearing like a blue dress. And then he's like, hey, you want some quiche, some quiche?
Right. And then she's wearing like a black dress.
Right. And not just like a black dress. It's like a black evening gown.
Right. And then when they go to City Hall in the next scene, isn't she wearing something else?
Yeah.
Like she changes she again?
Yeah. So I don't know. It's. It's fucking weird, man.
It is weird. Where did James Bond learn? When did he have time to learn how to make a fucking quiche? Is what I need to know as well.
Well, James Bond knows everything.
Apparently.
Right? He knows everything.
I'm trying to think if there's an odd vehicle that. Oh, of course, the snowboard. He knows that. He did that earlier.
Yeah. We've never seen James Bond snowboard. And snowboard, not on an actual snowboard, but on.
you know, one of the skis from a snowmobile. How that thing stuck on his feet, I'll never know.
Because he's James Bond.
Because he's James Bond. Literally any conveyance, he can operate. Even if it's a board, a stick on his feet, he will operate it like a master. So Bond and Stacy meet with Chief Geologist Howell at City Hall, who immediately fires Stacy. I forgot why he fires her, but she got fired.
Because he's in cahoots with Zorn. She has too many questions.
I forgot the excuse that he gave, but yes. Yeah, she's prying too deep. Bond and Stacy go back. They plan to go back to City Hall. So they're sitting in a room with Chuckley. and they plan to go to City Hall while Chuckley goes to Washington, you know, for you know, to get the cavalry set up.
To Washington? I think he just had to go to the FBI field office in San Francisco. I don't think he had to fly across the country.
Yeah, that seems like a bit of a waste. What are you going to do? Like, fly a fleet of, you know, FBI or CIA agents
right.
all the way back to San Francisco? I don't know, man. I don't know. Yeah, because he's like, don't waste any time. We only have a day. Like, it takes 6 hours to fly to across the country. And then another six back. That's half your day.
Right. No sleep. No sleep for Chuck Lee.
Maybe a permanent sleep for Chuck Lee. Because he gets into his car, which I would not expect him to have.
What, to have like a Jeep Wrangler, basically?
Yeah, yeah. There's something about little old Chuck Lee that I just did not expect him to have this big ass, you know, Jeep 4x4. And he gets murdered in his car. He gets murdered in his car, unbeknownst to Bond and Stacy. When Bond and Stacy come out after canoodling, I guess, they see Chuck Lee's car leaving. So I guess they assume that Chuck Lee is on his way to Washington. What were they doing all that time that Chuck Lee was getting strangled to death?
I don't know. Just fucking around.
Just chilling, huh?
Did they bang at this point, or was that, did they wait till the end of the film for that? I can't remember. Like I said, this part of the movie runs all like this is where you could probably trim a lot of fat out of this film. This like middle act, basically.
Yeah. Let me see. So back in Chantilly, I don't know. I can't remember if this is right. Back in Chantilly, Zorn tried to buy out a hesitating Stacy, who is now threatened by Zorn's thugs.
We've kind of covered this part of the film. This is a subplot that is not important whatsoever.
Yeah, this is not.
Basically, they go back to City Hall at night at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, because we've covered that part. So at City Hall, Zorn arrives, and he arrives with Mayday, and I mean, Christopher Walken is doing his Christopher Walken thing that he does, and I'm looking at the expressions that Stacy gives, and like, she's a terrible actress.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. She shrieks a lot in this film.
Yeah, she does. And she can't really, and she doesn't know how to scream. Mm-hmm. Like, they have professional screamers in Hollywood for actors and actresses that don't know how to scream. Like, I'm one of those people that don't know how to scream. Like, it just doesn't sound right.
No, well, because usually when you express surprise, it manifests itself in an obscenity of some kind, I would imagine. Like, much like I do.
Yeah. Yeah. Surprise, anger. Joy, yeah. Pretty much any emotion. So Max and Mayday, they get the jump on Bond and Stacy. they all go into the chief geologist's office. And instead of, I mean, instead of just killing all three of them right then and there,
Well, he was trying to frame Bond is what he was trying to do here.
But why was he trying to frame Bond?
Because that way, I guess that covers his tracks. Because basically, I think him and Mayday were going to make sure that the records of Zorin, like working with this chief geologist, were destroyed, essentially. And they were trying to tie off that loose end. And then, you know, the perfect patsy falls into their lap in order to do this. Because that way they could kill this guy and have Bond be to blame. Because he actually uses Bond's gun to shoot the guy.
I get that, but like, why wouldn't he just kill him?
But like, because then you can't explain Bond's death. But you can trap him in an elevator and set the building on fire, which would then give you a convenient out, I guess. Except for all the gasoline you dumped all over the place.
Yeah,
like, you know.
I mean,
besides
like
it's a pretty tidy plan.
Maybe
for a psychopath.
Maybe Bond was, maybe the idea was that Bond put the gas there, but he's so incompetent that he got trapped in his own trap.
I guess now I think you're giving the movie too much credit.
Yeah.
Right. Now.
You know what? You're right.
Main strike.
Hey, I know that place. That's an abandoned silver mine by the San Andreas Fault.
Alive and well, I see. And still bungling in the dark.
Well, then why don't you enlighten me, Zorin?
You're out of your depth. And you, sudden. You should have accepted my more than generous offer.
You can take your offer.
Don't bother, Stacey. He's a psychopath.
You two have joined forces? That simplifies things. He's probably armed.
Stacey, Mr. Zora.
Call the police, Mr. Howe.
What's going on?
Tell them there's been a break-in. Ask them to get here as soon as possible.
You're being used, Mr. Howe.
Do it. Hello. We've had a break-in here. City Hall, Office 306. Come at once. What have they done?
You discharged her. So she and her accomplice came here to kill you. Then they set fire to the office to conceal the crime. But they were trapped in the elevator and perished in the flames.
But that means I would have to be
dead. That's rather neat, don't you think?
Brilliant. I'm almost speechless with admiration.
Intuitive improvisation is the secret of genius.
But again, we have the opportunity for a fantastic Christopher Walken scene, because basically he's talking to the chief geologist, and I dropped the audio in already. Because, but he's like, you know, tell them that there's a murder at City Hall. And the chief geologist like dawns on him. He's like, but wait, that means that I'll have to be. And his word is like, that's right, dead. And then he shoots him.
like, we get it, Chris. Right. We get it. Like, you don't have to spell it out. I don't know. And Bond is like
the only thing, you know what this scene reminds me of more than any other thing? It reminds me of the scene at the end of Batman Returns when him and Batman and Catwoman are all like in the same area.
Yeah.
And what the fuck? They're in the Penguin's lair and Batman pulls off his mask and it's Bruce Wayne underneath. And Christopher Walken's character is like, Bruce Wayne why are you dressed like Batman? And Catwoman's like, well, because he is Batman. Correction, was Batman. And then he fucking shoots him. Like, I flash back to that scene all the time whenever I see this part.
Oh, shit. Didn't he play a guy named Max in that movie,
yes,
too?
Yes, he did, actually. It was Max Schreck. That's what it was.
Oh, I like to think that...
the same character. That's pretty much it.
Much like how James Bond can't have an alias whose first name isn't James, Max Zorin can't have an alias. He survived his supposed death, and set up shop in Gotham City. Jesus Christ. Intuitive improvisation is the secret of genius. That is a line from a psychopath. This scene is, you know, they do a lot of, they set them up, right? They trap them in the fire. They light the thing, and they trap them in an elevator, and they light the place up. Bond gets out of the elevator, and Stacy's like, don't leave me. Don't leave me. And she climbs out and she's like, what are you doing, James? Don't leave me. Like, and then he doesn't say anything. He's right. Just moving. Right. And she's like, James, like she's screaming like that horrible scream at the top of her lungs. And it's just funny to me. Cause it's like, what if he just dipped out?
That's right. Just left her there.
And just kind of left her.
She really doesn't do anything in the last third of the movie.
She really doesn't.
Like,
man.
She doesn't help. Like, I guess she drives the fire truck in the next scene. But other than that, like, she literally does nothing.
Yeah. She does nothing but scream and get on my nerves. So James comes down from the burning building with a ladder that the fire department used.
Oh, by the way, they actually lit up City Hall for this scene. Like Diane Feinstein was like, yeah, just go ahead and set a fire on the roof of City Hall. It's fine. I'm not even kidding. And then the best part is they actually had like the fire trucks hosing down the front of the building, and they left a note to all the people that worked in City Hall saying, hey, make sure you close your windows before you leave work tonight. And one guy did not.
Oh shit.
And had a fucked up office the next morning.
Oh shit.
Because they got hosed down by the fire trucks.
That is hilarious. God, wow, she really wasn't playing.
She went all out, man.
God,
she went all out.
Oh man. James Bond carries Stacy out like Kevin Costner in The Bodyguard. and the cops are like, "Hey, this your gun?" And James Bond was like, oh, yeah, thanks. And just like, well, we're going to have to arrest you, buddy. like
you, but I'm a secret agent. Call anyone.
Right.
I'm the world's worst, most less secretive agent that's ever been.
Right. The guy was like, yeah, well, the guy's like, yeah, well, I'm Dick Tracy, and you're still under arrest. Right. So a chase scene happens, right? Because they got to get away, and
jump to a fire truck.
They jump and they have a chase with a fire truck, and
this is fun. This is a fun scene. Of course, the roof ladder becomes dislodged while Bond is riding on it. So of course it swings out into the roadway, and Bond is hanging for dear life, or a stunt double's hanging for dear life, exactly. And you get some nice green screenshots of Roger Moore close up as you go through the scene.
It's a fun scene. I like it a lot. It culminates with the cops getting stuck on a drawbridge.
Yeah, so they actually jumped the fire truck over the bridge, by the way, when they did this. Destroyed the suspension on it, as one would expect once they did it.
I wouldn't know if they jumped the fire truck across the bridge for real, because there was no slide whistle.
That's true. That's a good point. And also, I think, Micah, I think this denotes the first ever incidence where a vehicle in a Bond movie was on a sloped surface and did not spontaneously combust. Because the cop car sure tried to drive up that drawbridge as it was going up, and somehow they did not explode.
Oh shit.
I have a question for you, sir. Mm-hmm. So this is by my count, there have been three incredibly notable car chases in movies that take place in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So there's this. There's the very famous car chase scene from the movie Bullet.
Yep.
And there's the car chase scene from recent No Time to Bleed episode topic, The Rock.
Mm.
So which do you think out of those three is the most superior car chase?
I mean, I got to go with, like, as much as I love Nicolas Cage and The Rock in general, like that movie. And I like Michael Bay, like action. Like that's the only time Michael Bay does stuff right. I gotta go with Bullet.
I do too. Bullet's a timeless one.
It's timeless, man. Like without Bullet, you might not. Well, I won't say you might not have these. Someone would have figured it out,
right?
Like, well, there's a city with a bunch of hills. Let's jump them. But they get the privilege of being first. So they, you know.
Well, I think the thing that also works really well in Bullet's favor is that it's the sound design in that car chase is really well done. Because basically, like, you have this really ominous music leading up to it. But then as soon as the action starts and they start gunning the engines, there's nothing but the sound of the chase for the next 7 minutes, basically.
Yeah.
And it's really well done.
Yes. So apparently the SFPD just decides to give up on that missing fire truck.
That's right. There's a fucking fire truck running through the streets of San Francisco. And they're just like, well, we tried, guys. We were defeated by this drawbridge that we could easily lower now. And we could easily radio for other units to continue the pursuit on the other side of the bridge. But you know what? Power to them. They did a great job. They got away. What can we say? Let's get back to...
Look, it's the end of my shift.
San Francisco Fire Department's like, hey, you guys lost the truck. Yeah, we'll just buy another one. It's not a huge deal. It's not a problem.
And Bond and Stacey drive that fucking fire truck all the way to the mine that Project Main Strike. That's the name of the project, right? Main Strike?
It is Project Main Strike, yes.
Which is the lamest code name for a fiendish operation ever.
Right? It's not worse than Operation Grand Slam?
I kind of like Grand Slam because Grand Slam is a term.
So Main is Main Strike.
Main Strike is a term?
It can be. I think it is a term, actually. Hang on a second. If I type in main strike, let's see what happens here.
Main grand slam. It's like, all right, you know, I get it. Like, you want to hit a grand slam. Like, you want that, right? Like, it's main strike. I don't know.
Actually, I think this term actually makes more. Oh, no, never mind. I just typed in main strike mine, and they referred to this. Now there is a mining term called the main break, which happens basically. Let's see here, main break. I'm looking through a geology website. This is where we're at right now. This fucking movie. I think this is somewhat of like a mining term, which kind of makes sense.
If it's a mining term in
the context of the film.
If it's a mining term, then it makes sense. If it's not a mining term, it's dumb. Project Main Strike. You know, Project Apt Blow. Like, you know, that's what that sounds like to me. Anyway, they make it to the mine. And here's a quick scene, a little bit of a trivia nugget that I found on IMDb.
All right.
So they have to disguise themselves as Zorin Industries workers. And Roger Moore ad-libs a line that the line goes, you know, when they're putting on their jumpsuits or whatever, Roger Moore says to Stacey Sutton, I forgot her name already. he says, "That's a good idea of yours," meaning to, you know, dress up like the enemy. "Pity you couldn't find one that fits." And that's just Roger Moore being a dick. And Stacey, you know, the actress comes out and gives him like a little bit of an attitude, right? But then she plays it off.
Well, that was a sarcastic line, because actually what happened is that when Tanya Roberts first put on the coveralls, she was like swimming in them, because they didn't have any that were her size. So she actually had the costume designer like tailor the fucking jumpsuit to her.
Yeah.
So when she's wearing it in the film, like, it's a fucking like it looks like it's supposed to fit the way it's supposed to fit. So I think that line was a sarcastic line, because it fit her so well.
Ah.
That was the end result.
Oh, okay.
I thought that was a pretty good quip, actually.
I thought that was, so I read somewhere that was Roger Moore being a bit of a dick, and that she was giving a little bit of a toot, and they wanted to do another one, and the director was, and John Glenn was like, "Oh, you being a bitch? Well, fuck you. I'm going to use that one where you were swimming. I'm going to use some scenes where you were swimming in them. How about that?" But I stand corrected.
So this mindset, they built for real, as they do for these films. But when they were, Legend, Ridley Scott, their Ridley Scott movie was filming at Pinewood Studios before this, and they actually, an accident happened. They burned down the soundstage there. So they were kind of freaking out. So they actually had to reconfigure the schedule for filming and basically film everything but the scenes in the mine, because they found out that once they cleared the site, that they could actually get the soundstage rebuilt within 3 months' time, essentially. Hmm. So Peter Lamont, who's the production designer, actually started he was building the stage while the actual soundstage was being built around the set, essentially. Jesus. And so he came up with this intricate mine. It was fully floodable. So like the flood that you see in the film, they were able to do that for real, the way that they designed it. So it's very, very impressive. Even though it doesn't look impressive, because it's, you know, a fucking mine, it's a nice impressive feat of design. And they actually, like, the railway they actually had in there, much like the set from You Only Live Twice, actually did go all the way around the entire set. So you could just travel it in a rail car, essentially.
Oh, nice. All right. This is, I take it back, right? I take it back, what I said about the time. This is literally them running around doing nothing for 10 real time minutes.
Yeah.
Nothing goes on.
There ain't shit going on.
Absolutely nothing goes on here. And I timed it. It's like 8 minutes and eight and change. A lot of that could be cut out. Like, that's ridiculous. Zorn soon, so I'm just going to skip past all this. Like, they give a little exposition and all that. I'm going to skip past all of it. Zorn, begins to flood the mine with the first set of explosives in his trap, in his plan. Someone is like, "Hey, Zorn, you know, what about all these people who are loyal to you?" And he's like, "Fuck them." And
no, it's like he's getting ready to flood the mine, and like the foreman was like, he's like, "My men are down there." He's like, "Yeah, a remarkable coincidence."
God, sure, I miss villains
they,
like
they
this.
They sure
man.
Are. And then he just starts machine gunning all of the workers, basically.
Roger Moore.
This is a great fucking scene.
Roger Moore cited this scene in particular as one of the reasons why he doesn't like this James Bond.
Zorn is a dick, man. He's right. Fucking killing everybody.
He's just killing people. He was like, "That's not a James. That's not a Bond film. Just the bad guys killing people mercilessly. That's not a Bond film. What are you talking about? What do you do?
His plot is literally kill millions of people or thousands of people.
Right.
Right. But meanwhile, Mayday is also like Mayday was chasing Bond down through the mine ways. So, and she was also trapped. Basically, the only people to that would survive this would be Zorin and his number two guy, essentially.
Yeah. Zorin, I'm watching the scene now. Not only are these people running for their life, Zorin takes the classic 80s villain weapon of an Uzi.
Right.
And starts gunning people down.
And he's laughing about it while he's doing it, too. Like, that's the best part, is he's fucking, like he's got the biggest smile on his face as he's just killing all these people with this machine gun.
Like, this image of Max Zorin, wealthy industrialist, in a brown... in a blue blazer, white shirt, and khaki slacks, and a hard hat, gunning down mine workers with a goddamn Uzi. Just it's an image of like corporate greed that I think should be like that should be the flag for corporate greed. Just that image on a flag. It's but yeah, man, I miss villains like this, man, who are just bastards.
Right.
I think more films need that, man. Anyway, Mayday is like, what the fuck, yo? So she decides to switch sides because she's like, he left me to die, so fuck him. I'm gonna side with you because you've been inside me also.
It's as good a reason as any, I guess.
She changes sides and aids Bond in removing the bigger bomb that would destroy the lock by putting the device on a hand car and pushing it out of the mine. So there's this like master like a keystone like type area, and if you blow it up, that will be the thing that crumbles the mine, destroys everything. The first one is to get the water in here, and the second one is to send it out.
To flood it, yeah.
Mayday sacrifices herself by pushing the bomb out of the location where it needed to.
Well, because they tried to push the handcart out, but the brake failed, so they had to have someone stay on the cart itself. And hold the brake open,
yeah.
As it whirled out of there, and Bond tried to sell her, and of course she does this weird like get Zorin for me, and she's like waving her fists in the air, and she's riding on this fucking mine car.
She can't even like she. She can't even just say, get out of here.
It was more like get Zorin for me, something like that is how the inflection actually was. Very strange.
I love how Grace Jones' mascara and eyebrows appear to be tattooed on as she has been submerged in water on numerous occasions.
Yes.
And it's perfect. It's perfect. Not only that, her hair is immaculate.
Yes, hasn't moved the entire film.
I don't know if you know, but there is a thing about black women and their hair. And you cannot get that shit wet. You just can't. Like, if it's done and done up, if you get it wet, that is hundreds of dollars down the drain, and that's it. Like, when my wife gets her hair done, she doesn't want to sweat. That's how much you cannot get a black woman's hair wet. So to have Grace Jones's hair be and makeup just be immaculate is a testament to how badass Mayday is.
And like I said, she ends up being a hero at the end of the day. I love it. Zorin's in the blimp, and they're just waiting for the mine to explode. And then all of a sudden, out comes this mine car with a bomb on it. And he looks and he's like, "Mayday, curse!" Like almost Seinfeld esque in that moment. Newman.
Oh shit. That's funny. Like, I wanted my A View to a Kill, but I didn't get it.
Now, why after the bomb made it clear of the mine, would she not have jumped off? Not that she had a ton of time to do this, But you think that she would have, like, once you were outside, once you were clear of the explosives, you would have just, you know, jumped off at that point.
Yeah.
And saved yourself.
Or at least try, you right. know? Like, you might not have made it out of the blast radius, but I would give it a shot. Right. I don't know. I don't know. Maybe she wanted to die. It was like, finally, I get to be off of this fuckhole fuck-ass movie. That's why Roger Moore was so adamant. He was like, oh, no, please, please. I will take care of Bond.
Let me. Oh, my goodness. And of course, like, Bond runs out of the mine at this point. And Stacy, for some reason, is on, like, on top of a hill. And she's like, James, I'm up here. And then fucking, you know, Walken sees her. And so they're able to just scoop her up in the blimp.
Apparently. Yeah, which is kind of weird. Like, how the hell did that blimp get from that high up to that far down?
Well, they weren't flying that high. I think the bigger question is, how is she able to get to such a high hill in such short order? And how was that hill so isolated that the blimp could just swoop down, get her, and then just fly right back up in the air again, but not high enough that Bond couldn't grab, like, the cable hanging down from the balloon to go along for the ride, essentially. Very strange.
Very strange indeed. Like you said, Bond grabs onto a rope, and he's climbing up to the blimp. The Zorn tries to knock Bond off the rope.
On the Bay Bridge,
which, I mean, look, say what you want about this movie. This is a classic scene. And
oh, for sure. And actually, they actually got permission to have stuntmen go up and film some wide shots on the actual bridge itself.
It is a great use of a well-known landmark.
Yes.
Which is something other than blow it up. You know what I mean?
True, or destroy it, you know, using it as a walking bridge to get to Alcatraz Island or something like that.
Right, like every X-Men movie.
Right,
like,
right. Now they also did, they also had like a number of models, obviously, if they could actually film the actors on stage. So they had a full-scale model of the North Tower, which is where the hand-to-hand fighting comes. And then they also had like some quarter scale models of the bridge itself, for like close shots of the blimp and stuff like that as well.
Very cool. Very cool. Yeah, I like this scene, man. And look, I have my biases. But I think this scene is cool. Bond manages to moor the airship to the framework of the bridge. Sutton attacks Zorin. And in the fray, Dr. Mortimer and Zorin's number two are temporarily knocked out.
Yes.
Sutton decides it's too dangerous in this enclosed space.
So I'm going to go out on top of this bridge. Yes. Yes.
She joins Bond on the bridge. Zorin follows them with an axe.
Bond has basically tied the cable to the bridge, so like the blimp can't fly away at this point.
Yeah, it can't go anywhere. And he's like, full throttle, like just go. And it's not going anywhere. This geriatric is holding on for dear life while hanging from the Golden Gate Bridge. And Zorin comes out with an axe. They get into a little bit of a fight. With Roger Moore there, it evokes like Metal Gear Solid 4 just a bit.
Kind of,
like,
sort of.
Just,
yeah,
kind
of sort of old men punching, that sort of thing, yes.
And Zorin eventually falls to his death.
He does, but not before doing a very Walken-esque smile as he realizes he's about to die. And he's like, you know what, fuck it, I'm going to die. This is going to be great. I can't wait to fall from the top of this fucking bridge. And of course, the good doctor sees, as like, wakes up just in time to see his protege, his creation fall. And he is, of course, aghast. at this point. So his plan is to get a stick of dynamite from the blimp, which, why you not carry dynamite on a blimp, but all right.
Not a stick, a bundle.
Oh, an entire bundle? Okay.
A bundle of
and
dynamite.
Somehow he's going to light this and throw it at Bond with precision timing so that it blows up as it reaches Bond, I guess?
He's going to cook the bundle of dynamite.
Right. But of course, Bond has the genius idea to cut the cable with the axe that Zorn left behind, therefore causing the blimp to jerk backwards, which means the stick of dynamite falls into the cabin and eventually explodes. And of course, since it is a helium blimp, the entire blimp goes up with it, essentially.
Oh,
huge explosion.
It's a huge explosion. It what a way to just end a Roger Moore's last run as James Bond.
Right.
How did they get down?
Who knows? I mean they do have towers that run up, you know, like elevators that run up for maintenance purposes.
Yeah.
To that section of the bridge. So it's not like that's how they got up there in the first place to do the filming for those shots. So.
But they're kinda like they're on the I guess they just walked up the wires of the bridge. I just can't.
We're concerning ourselves with semantics here.
I know. It's just like it's not. He's 57, and he's not like 2017 57.
I get it. And she's already proven she can't hang from anything without freaking out. Right. Apparently, so I get it.
Bond is awarded the Order of John Lennon by General Gogol.
You mean the Steve Bannon Memorial Award?
They're like, hey, where's Bond? And they're like, oh, we think he's dead. And
I can't even with the scene. Q is in a van outside of Stacy Sutton's house, but instead of just, I don't know, knocking on the door and saying, hello, 007, it's Q, I'm just coming to see if you're still alive, he sends in the fucking robot dog to see what's going on.
I don't know if you remember, like, we all know what's coming, right? Like, we all know what's coming, so to speak, right? Like, this is the end of the movie, this is where James Bond finally nails the Bond girl for the second or third time, depending on which movie it is. And right when the robot dog scene where you see him come through the door, right before you see him come through the door, the camera is facing it. The camera is focused on the cat. She has a cat and it's focused on the cat bed and the cat bowl that the cat eats its food out of. And this cat, would you like to know what the cat's name is?
Oh, I don't remember, so I'll be glad to hear you tell me.
The cat's name is Pussy.
Of course.
Because, of course, James Bond is getting pussy, and lo and behold, the cat's name is Pussy. Just in case you didn't know what was about to happen, they literally spell it out for you.
I mean, they're also in the shower together, of course.
They're in the shower together, and keeping the British end up, or having sex a full time, or, you know, whatever. And Q, the pervert, is watching them get it on. And yeah, that's it, man. And then we hear that awesome song again.
Yes.
And that's it, man. That's A View to a Kill. And
this movie is such trash, but God damn it, I can't resist it.
It's a guilty pleasure.
I can't resist
it,
Siren Song. I can't do it.
It's a guilty pleasure.
So, by the way, we actually have box office numbers now for these films because we're in modern times. As it were.
Excellent.
So 1985 was a loaded fucking year for movies. Mm-hmm. Like there were a lot of notable movies that came out in 85. This made it to the 13th highest grossing film in the US.
Wow.
But it was down about 17 million from Octopussy. So this is where the slide really starts to begin for the Bond franchise.
Mm.
So that kind of sucks.
That does
but
suck.
Yeah, man, like I said, this is the most conscious I am watching a movie that it is hot garbage. But goddamn, does Christopher Walken come in and save the day.
Yeah, he does.
And be all Christopher Walken-y doing his Christopher Walken thing. By the way, fun fact, first ever Academy Award winner cast in a James Bond film.
Oh, really?
Was Christopher Walken, yeah.
That's a... you wouldn't know it.
No,
that sure he was an Academy Award winner.
You sure would, but he certainly had won one at that point. And there he is. He would not be the last. The other one, also hilarious, you would not know that they were an Academy Award winner when they were cast in this film. Ah. In the film that they were in.
Ah, excellent.
That would be Halle Berry, so.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
You sure did. You sure did. But yeah, so but this is also the end of Roger Moore's seven-film tenure. Woo! As James Bond. We made it.
It has been a long 7 months. I mean, my God.
I mean, there has to be some stuff that you really liked.
No, I joke. I kid. Roger Moore's not a bad Bond. He's certainly not my favorite Bond. And, you know, I tend to play in extremes for the sake of comedy. But I can see why people like Roger Moore. Like, a lot of people who are half a generation older than us really, like, this was their James Bond.
And that's true. Like, if you talk to those people, like, he's very fondly remembered.
Yeah.
Among Bond fans. A lot of Bond fans from this era specifically.
Yeah. And I don't absolutely hate his movies. I really don't.
You know what, though? I gotta say, as fucking goofy as he was in a lot of his films, I do really feel like that he was chiefly responsible for maintaining the franchise, because I think if you brought in another Connery, I think it would have died off because it would have felt too samey after a while. But I think the feel of his movies and how they were a lot lighter and a lot more humorous were able to keep it going throughout the 70s and 80s when the world changed a lot too in that time. And I feel like that little bit of lightheartedness was able to keep people wanting to go back to the theater more and more.
Yeah.
So I do actually credit him with the longevity of the franchise. And plus, man, he had some badass scenes in his movies. I don't think he gets credit for his badassery in the few times that it pops up in these seven films.
They're few and far between, and you don't really notice them because he's more of a prim proper stereotypically Englishman, you know. But nah, man, he wasn't bad at all. He has a few movies that are genuinely good. I like those movies. He has some movies that are bad.
Yeah, these last two are very not good.
These last two are very not good. One of them I just don't care for, and the other one I genuinely like.
Right.
So, you know, you're right. He carved out his own type of James Bond.
Right.
And like you said, he was able to kind of mainstream it a little bit.
Now, that being said, like, he did also, not his fault, he was saddled with some of the worst writing and directing that the franchise has ever seen. Mm-hmm. Like John Glenn, I genuinely do not like him as a director in these films. I really don't. Like, and I actually really like For Your Eyes Only, but that's because I think that he was kind of sticking to the establishment for the film because that was his first one. And then as he got more latitude to do what he wanted, that's where you started to see the decline a little bit throughout his movies.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think Roger Moore gets a little bit of a bad rap from some people. And I get why people don't like the goofy, the lightheartedness and stuff like that, but it's definitely like, and you're going to, as we get into the next two films,
boy,
specifically, you are going to be glad that you had a little bit of levity.
I mean, because it must be like, at first I thought it was like an American thing. No, it must be a human being thing to literally just overcorrect.
Right.
And you didn't like Lighthearted Bond? Well, get ready for the angst.
Oh, it's coming. It's coming hardcore.
Good God.
And you, but you know what's ironic about Beauty and the Kill too? He really didn't have a lot of gadgets for as fucking nutty as this movie was. Like, his biggest gadget was polarized sunglasses that had X-ray vision.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't have a lot of goofy shit. Now, in the next movie, it's super serious, but he has all kinds of toys in the next film.
So, I mean,
I don't know. Dude, I always enjoy watching this movie. I can't help it. Every part of my logic and mind says, this movie sucks. Stop having a good time. This, like, what the fuck are you doing? You're killing brain cells watching this film. And then the other part of me is like, but Christopher Walken, though.
Yeah,
and,
man.
And there's a fucking fire truck chase and all this stuff. Like, it's so much fun. What are you doing?
Man. Like,
they're fighting on top of a bridge.
If it was dull, like, that would be one thing. But like you said, there's so many little bits in here. Like that's why I didn't feel the length of this movie.
Right.
As much as I did some other movies, because it's so fun. Like, it's an action movie, man. Like, it's an action movie. It's James Bond's version of an action movie, of an 80s action movie. And yeah, I like it.
It's fun. What can I say? I admit its shortcomings, but I'd rather watch this over a lot of other better Bond films.
Yeah,
just because it's a good time. Tanya Roberts, notwithstanding, I just try to ignore her. Because she doesn't really get a lot of scenes by herself, which I'm fine with. I don't need it. So there you go.
There you go. Next month, we'll have a couple special guests. Next month, New Bond. A movie that this is the other movie that I can barely remember.
Well, good. This is the one. The movie next month is the one that nobody can remember.
Yeah, yeah. Whenever you think Timothy Dalton, you think License to Kill. But yeah, he did do one before that, and we will tackle that next month.
And there's a very interesting backstory to the casting of Timothy Dalton that not a lot of people might know. So stay tuned for that.
Yes, indeed. So until then, the men with the golden tongues.
Oh, thanks for subscribing to Premium.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If you listen to this, you are a member of the Nerdpocalypse podcast, TMP Studios Premium Network. We thank you for your patronage. Tell a friend. You get this show, and you get shows like No Time to Bleed, which another one is coming very soon.
It's gonna be a doozy. I can promise you that.
You get shows like Airing of Grievances. Jay and I just did one we talked about being at a barbershop, and we talked about my messed up hairline. And many, many more things coming in the future. I know we keep saying that, but like, for real, you have no idea how close it is before we can announce something. Jay wants to announce it so bad. And,
dude, there's stuff that I want to announce.
Yeah.
About, like, you know, dense pixels and things of that nature.
Absolutely.
That we just saw. It's, trust me, it's killing us to not be able to tell you guys about it yet.
Absolutely.
Believe me.
But, We thank you for subscribing. We hope you continue to subscribe. We hope you tell a friend, and we hope that you keep sending out those 5-star reviews for any one of our shows. If you send out a 5-star review for any one of our shows, we will read it on the air. No questions asked. So yeah, until next month, the men with the golden tongues will return in the living daylights.
Meeting you. With a view to a kill, face to face in